I'm Suzy Larson. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Suzy Larson Live. Welcome to Suzy Larson Live. Always honored to get to spend this time with you. In fact, I look forward to bringing you conversations every single day that hopefully inspire you in your faith walk, that deepen your understanding of God's Word, and that heightens your awareness of His very real presence in your life. Well, hope is defined in several ways. Believing something good is up ahead, an expectancy and desire for a certain outcome, and a trust that things will change for the better. Well, we've all hoped for certain outcomes that actually didn't materialize, but that's different than hoping in God, who never fails us. One of my favorite guys who's now with Jesus, Dr. Warren Wiersbe, once said that it's the difference between a hope-so hope and a no-so hope. But don't you think it's time for hope to make a comeback, given the times in which we find ourselves? So how do we get there? I mean, what's properly placed hope look like? And what does it look like when it seems like all hope is lost? Well, Danielle Strickland joins us today. It's so good to have her back on the show. She's got a new book titled The Other Side of Hope. And she writes this: I want to talk about the side of hope that doesn't look glorious or fabulous and doesn't really fit on the front of a greeting card. I want to talk about the side of hope we must hammer together and line our lives with if any of what we are wanting to live can be seen. We've got four copies to give away today. And if you feel like hope needs to make a comeback in your life, why don't you text the word book to get in on the drawing? 877-933-2484. A quick announcement. You've been hearing about it. We'll probably be advertising for about another week and then the registrations will close. But we're doing an online study. It's free on my book, Strong in Battle, Why the Humble Will Prevail. You don't even need to own the book. You just can hop on the website, myfaithradio.com. You register. Like I said, I think the registrations will be open for about another week and a half or so, maybe 2 weeks. And then the emails will start to come in September. So I hope you can join us. All right. Let me tell you about my guest. We'll get her on the show. Danielle Strickland is an author, speaker, trainer, and global social justice advocate. Her aggressive compassion, love that, has served people firsthand in countries all over the world, from establishing justice departments for the Salvation Army to launching global anti-trafficking initiatives. Affectionately called the Ambassador Fund, she's the host of the Danielle Strickland podcast, co-founder of Infinitum and Amplify Peace and Brave Global, and the founder of Women Speakers Collective. She's wife to Stefan and mother to three sons. Danielle, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks, Suzy. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, good to talk with you, too. And wondering, just as you're spending time with God these days, what's He been impressing upon your heart?
Oh, man, I have been walking through the Gospels again, Matthew's Gospel with Jesus, and I've been reading through the First Nations version slowly. And I am loving it. God has been speaking to me so much. So this morning, just talking to me about my words and my tongue and how it's connected to my heart. And there's many other things, but I love just a fresh take. You know, the word kingdom is translated good road from above. And anyway, I've been thinking through what it means to walk on the good road from above in today's world.
Yeah. What translation did you say you're reading from?
It's called the First Nations version. Wow. It's an indigenous translation of the New Testament. Just came out, I think, last year from IVP.
Wow.
It's so beautiful. Really good.
I will have to check it out. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Well, I've interviewed you a handful of times, and then we worked together on the writers' conference last year that we had. There's so much of your backstory I did not know. I just was amazed as I read your book. First of all, you're quite an adventurer. You ran away for the first time at age 5. Second time you ran away, your face landed on the local news. And then you opened another chapter with, I stole my first car at age 12. So it's time to fess up. you got to tell us your backstory. I did not know this. I'm so surprised.
Right. Well, that's funny. The first four or five chapters, I think, are all autobiographical stories, which is probably the first time I've really shared some of those things publicly like that. So it is kind of a refreshing thing to be able to just tell it without any kind of, I don't know. There's always something weird about sharing your background story. I feel like in the Christian world, it becomes a bit of a circuit.
Yeah, right.
And people always want to hear that story. And you're like, but there's so much God's doing right now I'd love to tell you about. So it's fun to share it this way later, you know. I just, in the book, share a little bit about my parents' sort of story, how they were rescued out of poverty and addiction and things. And then just kind of how some of those things changed the trajectory of our family's life, but also kind of some residue of that, some sexual abuse, some dysfunction, caused my own pain, which resulted in rebellion. And what I would have thought was just rebellion for years until, you know, memories of that sexual abuse. And then also just like some, I guess, godly sorrow in dealing with some of those stuff led me to understand that a lot of that was pain, unmanaged pain. Yeah.
It is amazing what pain will do. And if you talked about this in the book, how your parents really wanting to do a good thing invited your uncle as a young man, I think, and maybe he was a young boy, but to live with you. But he was from a sexually abused scenario, which he perpetuated that on you and your sister, and living with that secret and yet acting out in such incredible pain. I mean, with the things that happened when you were a child. And you talk about this point where you landed in jail on drug charges, and a woman named Joyce came to visit you. Talk about that encounter.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite chapters, Jesus, Joyce, and Mr. Rogers, I think, right? Mm-hmm. And the guy whose car we had stolen was named Mr. Rogers, of all people. And it's not the Mr. Rogers, but still, my friend and I were very callously singing, you know, "It's a Terrible Day in the Neighborhood." Mm-hmm. Anyway, I was dead inside, you know, lost, and probably even still drug induced, dead, and in a holding cell by myself. And Joyce, who went to my parents' church, was part of the Salvation Army. She got in. I don't even know how. You're not even supposed to be able to have visitors there, but she got in. And instead of giving me a lecture, which I thought was coming, she just wrapped her arms around me and hugged me and said, "I love you." I did not hug her back. I did not say, "I love you" back. I actually shouted out after her, "You didn't even bring me a smoke," you know, like totally ungrateful and still kind of callous and dead. But when she left, I remember the cell door closing and I was alone. And Jesus showed up in precisely the same way. He just wrapped his arms, didn't say a thing to me, wrapped his arms around me and whispered in my ear, "I love you." And it wasn't like a magic pill I took, you know, which is often how we talk about conversion. You know, then everything was better when I lived happily ever after. That's not what happened. But I did awaken. I did see something I never saw before. I understood God was love. I got that he was for me, not against me. That was new to me. And I got that I wasn't alone. He was with me in my deepest, darkest place. And that was new to me. I thought I had to hide those sort of things from God, clean up my life, and maybe then that love might come. But that was the opposite of that. And then I saw that where I was wasn't good. I saw where this was headed. And that was new. Up until that, I didn't really care. Up until that moment where I was awakened, I didn't really care where I was. It didn't matter much to me, the consequences of my actions.
Well, repeated sexual abuse does that to you. You know, it kills your soul.
Yes.
To the point where life or death is sort of the same. And so at this point, when you were acting out, you'd said your sister was the first to kind of tell people what had happened. Had she told people at this point, or were you both kind of keeping it suppressed?
Yeah, no, we were both pretty suppressed. My sister, probably about maybe 20 years ago, the first inkling of it came out, and then, but not the fullness of it, probably till about a dozen years ago. And in all seriousness, I don't know if it's because of drugs or how deep my suppression was, but I don't remember some of the instances that she remembers even still. I have no memory of them. I have memories about the things I shared in the book. Like all those things are I have my own memories for, but there are more than that. I just don't recall all of them.
I'm first of all so sorry that you had to walk through that. It's so horrific. And as Jesus met you in that cell and began the tenderizing process, I mean, you even talked about your conscience was dead. You didn't even feel like you were faced with people, the man who was injured and that when you robbed a store and those things, and it didn't affect you until Jesus got in there and tenderized you. And what moves me so much about Jesus, it's the compassion that moved him to serve to a point of fatigue, but to minister to the crowds. His compassion is what compelled him to move. And his compassion is what compelled your heart to tenderize. What are the things happened after that, that continued the tenderizing process for you?
Well, I think once my eyes were opened, you know, my mother describes it like I never changed speeds. I just changed direction. So I just wanted to do better, to be better. You know, I think I did suffer from believing sort of in the magicness of conversion instead of in the process of it. And so I think I didn't pay early on. I didn't pay enough attention to some of the recovery type things that might have helped me uncover some of this pain in my life a bit sooner. So that's an interesting thing. I think I just replaced some of that stuff with good work. But anyway, I think some of those things that happened, I had I accidentally led someone to Jesus on a mission trip in Africa.
Oh my goodness.
In what I call the world's worst gospel presentation. Like, it was scarily horrible. And this woman ends up deciding to follow Jesus. And I remember, I literally remember being on a bench in Africa trying to read my Bible and just crying with the realization that I knew God could save anybody because he had saved me. But what I didn't know, which would change my life forever, is that God could use me to help save somebody. And as soon as I figured that out, it really literally changed a lot for me.
We're going to pause here. When we come back, I want to find out how and when that turn happened where you felt called to ministry. Because if you friends are not familiar with Danielle Strickland, you got to look her up, because you've been all over the world. You've served in some of the most, you know, scary places, really, in situations that maybe others would never go. And God has sent you there and used you in profound ways. And if you want a good story, you get one from Danielle. We've got some stories to tell that she shares in the book, The Other Side of Hope. Danielle Strickland's my guest today. Got a handful of copies to give away. You can text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. We'll be back in a minute.
Hey, this is Carmen LaBurge, host of Mornings with Carmen on the Faith Radio Network. I'm seeking to reconnect the eternal with the everyday. I do that in part through conversations about today's relevant issues, hopefully helping to equip you to bring Christ back into every conversation in your life. You can subscribe to my daily podcast at myfaithradio.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hope it's a great day for you. Thanks for tuning in to Susie Larson Live, talking to Danielle Strickland about a brand new book, The Other Side of Hope. And before the break, you're getting some backstory on her life story that maybe parts of it she's not shared in the past, but she's done a ton of work, justice work, work with Salvation Army, helped with anti-human trafficking efforts. So much. She has so much experience, and God has used her in profound ways. And it's just such a reminder, Danielle, of how, you know, he chooses the weak to shame the strong. You know, he reaches down from on high, rescues us from an enemy who's too strong for us. And then in due time, he trains us for battle to stand on high places. It's just amazing to me. So as you're coming out of a past, really acting and reacting out of sexual abuse with drugs and robbery and different things that just hard to even imagine. And then the Lord met you. When did you get a really about face sense that God is calling you to ministry?
Well, I think once I tasted that, you know, that accidental conversion where the woman that I was talking to really wanted to follow Jesus, and I was a part of that connection for her, I remember thinking, like, how do I do this with my life? And I think in many ways, I almost call it like another conversion, in the sense that I think my first conversion was this like awakening to the fact that God loved me and could be with me and show me a way out of all of this pain and brokenness. But then I think my second conversion was that I could be with him in doing some beautiful work in the world. And so in many ways, I think I was saved almost from a self-centered kind of religion or kind of salvation. And I'm so grateful. So that really, I literally just was like looking for any opportunity I could from that moment on to do it again.
It makes so much sense why the Lord led you to broken places, because you were familiar with brokenness, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I could feel it. I could touch it. I could, I have, of course, a lot of empathy. And then I also think I have a lot of hope as a result. Because I've seen God do it. And I've touched and felt a God who is with us in our deepest and darkest moments. And I think once you touch that, once you feel that, you know, like the psalmist says, now I know there's nowhere I can go and you're not there. That's hope.
Amen. Amen. Yeah. Well, you talk about in the book, you went to visit an art gallery and the pieces were turned backwards. Basically, you're looking at the backside of these pieces of art. Talk about that experience and really what you gleaned from it.
Yeah, I remember my friend was furious. She's an artist friend of mine who we drove an hour and a half out of our way to go to this gallery that featured artists she loved. And when we got there, the art curator had flipped every single thing over. And it was called The Flip Side, the series. And she was furious, but I was captivated. I was like, whoa. I mean, who even thinks about what's on the other side of art? You know, and no matter how great the painter was, or how, they could have been a beginner. My kid could have painted a thing. The other side of the canvas was the same for all of them. And it struck me that there's an ordinary backdrop to extraordinary beauty. Mm. There's these really simple framework things that we can do that creates our lives as a canvas that God then can display his hope on. And I was asking sort of questions about, yeah, I think even when we think about hope, we think about these glorious displays of it, but like postcards or, you know, whatever, paintings. But I was thinking a lot about what is the other side of that? How does that happen in people's lives? Like, how do our lives become places where God can display hope? And I pay a little bit of attention to the framework of how to live a life that is solid enough and ordinary enough that hope could actually show up.
Give us an example from one of your many stories where you've actually seen that happen.
Yeah. So, I'm trying to think of which one. Like, one of my favorite ones is Jan, who's a retired Baptist lady in Australia, who was a neighbor, you know, just lived a block away from a brothel, which is legalized in Australia. And she kept getting, her phone number turns out to be only 2 digits different from the local brothel's phone number. So she kept getting these calls, you know, for sex. She's a retired Baptist lady. She was appalled, you know, and was so uncomfortable and disturbed by it. She decided to change her number. But on the morning that she was going to change her number, God spoke to her while she was doing her devotions and said, "Why are you changing your number?" And she said, "I'm bothered by these calls." And he said, "I know, I've sent them to you."
Wow.
And so she met with me. I was the social justice director there for the Salvation Army and doing lots of anti-trafficking stuff. And I had hoped to get into the brothels as well, but I didn't know how. It was a conundrum because they're legalized. It was all like a tricky work. But we had coffee and she said, "God told me to go. What should I do?" And I didn't really know what to do, but I kind of faked it enough, like good leaders do, and asked some questions instead of giving some answers. And just said, you know, "What would you normally do if your neighbor was in an accident or someone just moved into your block?" You know, she's a beautiful Christian lady. She said, "Oh, that's easy. I would bake some cupcakes and I'd go visit." And I said, "That's it. That's what we'll do." And she said, "That's what we're going to do." And I was like, "Well, are they your neighbor? And, you know, like, is this not what you would normally do?" She said, "Yeah." So she bakes the cupcakes and we meet on a Tuesday and we go over to visit this brothel and we're going on out the door. And she says to me, "You know, I feel like I should do this by myself." And I was like, "I don't think you should. Like, I'm the professional here." And she looked at me and said, "Yeah, but I'm the neighbor." And I had this, you know, just flashback, of course, to Jesus's great instructions, like neighbor trumps professional every day in the scriptures, you know. But anyway, I said, "I'm going to go with you anyway, because I don't want you to die." my idea. Yeah. And so we went and I remember her going up to this brothel with these cupcakes and I'm praying for her like crazy. She's going up to the door by herself and I'm just standing there praying for her. Mm-hmm. And I'm praying down, you know, I'm just praying. Like, I've never prayed better in my whole life. I'm just praying mm-hmm. up a storm for favor, for protection, for everything. I mean, the stakes are high, it felt like. And this manager opens the door and he's like, "Oh, you know, what do you want? Like, who are you?" And I'll never forget. She went, I'm Jan and I brought cupcakes." And she like, she's shaking. She just brings these cupcakes in front of her. And I'll never forget, in my spiritual mind, I saw the demonic spirit of exploitation over Australia going like, "No, not the cupcakes." Cause this guy just opens the door. He's like, "Oh, okay. Cupcakes. Come on in." And she goes into the back and she meets about seven women working there and she gives them all cupcakes and introduces herself and says, "If anyone wants to come over and get an Aussie meal, you know, you can come to my house." Like, anyway, she makes a connection that's beautiful and she leaves and she's levitating, you know, and she just said to me like, "Wow, like God is at work." You know, and I said, "God is at work. He sure is." And I ran back to my headquarters. I called 10 of my craziest friends and I said, "Quick, we got to get busy. The Baptists are going to beat us to the brothels." And we started 10 teams. And they're like, "How are we going to do it?" And I was like, "I know exactly how to do it. Who bakes?" Wow. And we just started baking stuff and visiting brothels. We had teams who were visiting like 150 women, 10 teams across different, states of Australia. And we were able to rescue women. I mean, we were able to accompany women. Women got saved. We prayed for women. I mean, it was insane. When it came down to like a government inquiry on whether or not these things were connected, legalized prostitution and sex trafficking, you're never going to guess who they called to the stand. This is like a national parliamentary meeting. They called Jan.
Wow.
And they asked her, is there a connection? You know, I mean, it's just phenomenal. And I think that's just one of my favorite stories to tell, just because it's so beautiful, because it's like unsuspecting, natural, ordinary. Like what is super amazing about baking cupcakes and visiting a neighbor? You know, that seems like the most ordinary thing in the world if you're Jan. And God can take this framework of neighborliness, this ordinary idea of hospitality, this idea of saying like, I see you, you matter, I want a connection with you, and transform it into this incredible movement that could offer freedom to women everywhere. And I just, that's hope, isn't it? That's what hope is. Hope is not happy. Hope is honest. Hope doesn't avoid sorrow. Hope shows up in the middle of sorrow. Hope is the eternal presence that God is at work and inviting us to join him. And that, it just fills me with hope to think about it.
Wow. In even hope for Jan, because Jan then, you know, instead of despairing over what's happening in her neighborhood, which I'm sure she did, but that lament turned into action. Instead of getting her number changed, she decides to put feet to her faith and do what she can. I remember when I was speaking at an event in the upper Midwest where there was seasonal work, so a lot of trailers would come in, and I'd heard a lot of trafficking. And one of the ladies came up to my book table, broke my heart. She says, all these trafficked girls are, you know, at our local restaurants. And she literally said this. She said, other than giving them a dirty look, is there anything else I can do?
Wow.
And I'm like, oh. And so I pulled her aside and talked with her and hoped to change her mind and her perspective. And we need help. But I think not only did hope arise in that brothel, I mean, I really think that was like an act of spiritual warfare, but I imagine that hope arose in Jan's heart as well, you know?
Well, and this is the thing, one of the things I mentioned in the book about hope is that cynicism is spread and festers with spectating.
Wow.
And wow. Hope, because it's alive, because hope is living, it's not, and this again, it's like we think hope is like a principle I can take and live with in my life forever. Like it's a stagnant thing. But the Apostle Paul tells us that there's only three things that will remain that are eternal. And it's hope is one of them. It's faith, hope, and love. And that's why hope is so potent, so powerful, because it's eternal. It's a currency of eternal change. It matters forever. So whenever you touch hope, it's alive. You can't take it. It's not yours. It's not dead.
Yeah.
You can't shoot it and put it on your wall. It's a living thing. You're with it. So whenever you participate with hope, whenever you participate with God, you that's where hope lives, because
it's
in the present. It's in the present moment. So whenever you're spectating from the sidelines and looking at things from a distance, cynicism flourishes. But when you step in, that's where hope's found.
Come on, we've got a hard break here, so we're going to pause more with Danielle Strickland in just a moment. But boy, when you're spectating, that's when cynicism sets in. When you engage and activate, hope arises, not only in your heart, but in the hearts of those you're helping. That's how you know change is going to come, because somebody once said God does his best work through the hands and the feet of his friends. So may we respond accordingly. We'll be back in a minute. Thanks for tuning in to Susie Larson Live, talking to Danielle Strickland. She's got a brand new book out, The Other Side of Hope. Danielle, I'm going to admit, I thought I got a wrong printing because halfway through the book turned upside down. I'm giving something away here, but I thought, should I call someone? I get it. You got to talk about that, the flip side. Go ahead and tell us about that.
Yeah, that's the other day of just flipping things over, like flipping the script on cynicism and despair. What if it doesn't have the last word? What if there's another word besides that? And then, you know, we talked earlier about this idea of flipping over the painting, the glorious display. So on one side of the book are the stories where hope has been discovered from me, and they're from all over the world, and they're different contexts, and they're all different people. All of them very meaningful in my own life, where I was taught about a hope that's honest and not just happy. And then you flip it over, and the flip side is the theory and some of the tips that I've discovered as how to live a life with a solid enough framework where hope can actually show up.
Oh, I love that. Talk about what a solid enough framework might look like. Because you heard me at the open talking about the difference between a hope-so hope and a no-so hope. And unfortunately, we sometimes zero in on an outcome as if God is somehow bound by our dictates. And we say, if this happens, I'll trust him. And then we throw hope out. And yet we need that, a better framework than that. So maybe speak to what you've learned along the way.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of different things offered in that book from theology, sort of how we think about God and how we encounter God. So again, based that's kind of connected to my own story of thinking God was a certain way. He was angry. He was distant. He was maybe like even perpetually disappointed in my lack of abilities and my lack of goodness, and actually discovering that actually, no, that's not true. God is love. God is compassion. God is moved. God is with. God comes close. God goes low. And so that, even that theological framework of like stopping the distance between God and our deepest, darkest moments, not just our happy, most religious selves. So some theological things, I think how we view other people, the lens by which we see the world. So I talk a little bit about what I think has become a distorted theology of despair, which has taken sort of sin, which is a real brokenness in the world and even a brokenness inside of ourselves, but turned it into this like totally depraved kind of like how God sees us is through the lens of sin, how we see other people through the lens of sins, even how we look in the mirrors through the lens of sins. And I feel like God is saying to me, no, no, I don't see you that way. Sin is a middle word, not a final word and not a first word.
Wow.
And that it needs to be right sized in order for us to have a framework of hope. So I say it's a word. It definitely is a middle word. We're all living the consequences of that on a daily basis, but it's not the first word. The first word's sacredness and blessing. The first word over your life and my life is very good. I created you. And this came from even like tucking my son into bed. And I would say, who made you, Moses? And he would look at me and he'd go, God made me. And I would say, he sure did. And how did he make you? And he would say, he made me good. And I would say, yes, he did. He made you good. He made you fearfully. He made you wonderfully. He made, you know, like he knew, he knows the number of hairs on your head. And I would go through this whole routine with my son. And then I would leave the room and I'd go, I don't think I believe that about me. I don't think I knew that about me. I think I actually was taught in church the opposite of that. I sing the opposite of that. I've thought the opposite of that. So that partly getting that right, our relationship with God, how God sees us, how we see God, that's kind of an essential foundational truth that can help us. And then I'd say there's two things I call true dependency and true humility. And again, this is connected to how our theology is sort of our emotional practice of our own selves. So true humility is agreeing with God about who we are. That's my best definition I can find of true humility. So not insecurity, which is where a lot of us spend a lot of our times in insecurity with God and with others, where we're constantly trying to please people to get approval. Or we slide over into arrogance, or that's, and how you know you're in arrogance might not be your, what your words are saying, but your attitude is constantly trying to prove something. If you're constantly trying to please people or you're constantly trying to prove something, you're not actually operating out of true humility. And there needs to be some sort of a foundational shift into your life where you come into agreement with who God says you are. You see this principle at work in Jesus's life so well, right? And everyone that can come into agreement with who God says they are can come out of agreement with all the things that aren't true and can also stop trying to please and trying to prove and actually just try to serve. So that's a liberating foundational shift. And then I'd say true dependency is another shift where I move out of, what I would call self-sufficiency, which is like where a large part of our sort of Western Christian stuff goes to, like, I can do it. I've got it. And we live these very self-sufficient lives. And if we become get really honest with ourselves, we can actually live this life without God. Or we slip into codependency, which is like, I can do nothing. And we just kind of sit around passively waiting, you know, like that guy from the famous joke about like, you know, I want a boat or I need a rescue, you know, and we just don't participate with God. Somewhere on that continuum, we come into this, wait a minute, I could come into agreement with who God says he is. And consistently through scripture, God says he's present. He's with us. He's working and he can do what seems impossible to do. If we could get true humility and true dependency to align in our lives, that's what I call this center place leading from shalom, which is, it would mean that we would be living from wholeness.
Amen.
And if we could get there, oh boy, hope is endless.
just pure gold, just beautiful. Thank you so much. And to me, I could cry when I think about it, of you being in prison on drug charges and Joyce coming to see you and you expecting a lecture and you get a hug and then you get a card with an attorney's name on it. And then you get Jesus wrapping his arms, you know, just meeting you at your lowest point, not with a lecture, but a wraparound hug and an I love you. I mean, I just wonder how many people, even Christians who are serving, doing it all right, but they're not joyful inside. They don't have hope inside because there's places in there that are so suppressed, parts of their story they'd rather not bring up. But man, if the light of Christ could get in there, love of Christ, and as you say, they could align themselves with who God really is, they would come alive, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm hoping. I mean, I pray that it's useful in that way to people, that it could liberate them even to tell their own truth in a way that's, you know, not full of shame, but full of hope.
So good. If you don't mind, you also tell a story, a Christmas tree story about your mom and your dad. But first, if you could give backstory. I mean, I just fell in love with your mom when I think of her growing up years and what that little girl went through. But give us context for her life so that we can understand the Christmas tree story.
Yeah. So basically, both my parents come from poverty. My dad was actually illegally sold as a baby, so he doesn't even really know where he quite came from. He was sold into a home that couldn't adopt because they weren't considered mentally well enough.
Wow.
So you can imagine what that was like. So that was his backstory. My mom, she was a daughter of alcoholic parents who loved her but were broken, super broken by addiction. And so she was removed by the courts from her home in a sort of drunken brawl and went and lived with like a begrudging great aunt who kind of took her in, but not very kindly. And so, and actually, maybe a little bit better in terms of, life, wellness, like, you know, like a physical comforts, but a lot worse in terms of love. And so she was raised in that
Cinderella
home.
Without the prince, right? Wasn't she like living in the garage or something and having to serve, you know, in ways?
Yeah. That, and she found out years later, she found out that her mom, even though her mom was quite mentally unwell and addicted, sent her monthly care packages, you know, of new clothes and her favorite candy. Her home had given it to their kids instead.
Oh,
and
she
got all of the used stuff from her kids. Never told her that her mom sent her any of those packages all for years.
Wow.
I mean,
wow.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And then she was like secretly involved in sports because that wasn't allowed. And she won some kind of trophy and they threw it away. I mean,
That
is an emotionally abusive home, this poor girl. So
she lived in a lot of traumatic things and suffered from the results of that trauma for sure.
Mm-hmm. So bring us to the Christmas tree story. What happened?
Oh yeah. So this is a memory of a kid that my parents are fighting over this Christmas tree and my mom wants it to be perfect. And my dad keeps having to haul this thing out and, shave off the bottom of it until finally he gets so frustrated. He cuts it in half and brings it in. And it's this like little tiny Christmas tree now. And they're both just sort of enraged with each other. And I just use that as a scene as a kid, sort of asking this question, like, what's wrong? Like it's just a Christmas tree. Like what's happening right now? And then tell their backstories to kind of go like, oh, I see what's happening right now. My mom is after a perfect Christmas, the one that she dreamed about that she could never have. And my dad is just frustrated by never being enough. And you can see this, like kind of, as I look back on that story and many others that I didn't share, you can kind of see this like trauma and dysfunction sort of showing itself through some of these instances and some of this trauma. Then at the same time, you can kind of see the beauty and the hope in the backdrop as you think like, here are two people trying to make a really great Christmas for their kids who came out of places where Christmas wasn't an actual real life thing in their lives.
Wow. Did your mom, I'm not sure she's alive or not, but did she live to see you travel the world to minister?
Yeah, she's still alive and read the book. I of course I read it by my family before I published it. And she literally, like if I'm preaching somewhere, she's mostly crying, you know, just to think about what God had done. Because of course, even in the midst of my rebellion, you know, the enemy would whisper to her, like, this is what you had coming. You know, like just that the way that the thief just wants to keep stealing even your hopes of a future. And she talks in that season of her life, just not even being able to pray with words, just with weeping. And so to see God redeem what the enemy said was stolen, to see this trajectory of her lifestyle, then even her grandsons, you know, having a life that is so far different, even from mine, you see this redemptive progress of God. I mean, it's so hopeful.
Yeah. That is just, it's who he is and what he does. And I'm praying that hope arises in him this hour. Sherry just writes in, thank you for today. I needed this so much. Hope for my family today. Can't wait to get this book. We're going to pause here. When we come back, you're such an amazing storyteller. I mean, I'm thinking of Captain America. I mean, you've got a few stories. I would love for you just to tell some of your favorite stories where hope just rose up out of the ashes that just inspire and encourage us. Talking to Danielle Strickland about her book, The Other Side of Hope. And we'll be back in just a moment. Faith Radio podcasts are produced by the listener-supported ministry of Faith Radio. If you're interested in becoming a team member, a donor to this ministry, you can support the podcast anytime and donate at myfaithradio.com. Thanks for tuning in to Suzy Larson Live, talking to Danielle Strickland today. Her new book is titled The Other Side of Hope, and you literally have to flip the book over and turn it upside down to get the subtitle, Flipping the Script on Cynicism and Despair and Rediscovering Our Humanity. And she says, the truth about hope is that it pops up in the middle of what looks like a lost cause. When I've declared a situation too hard, it's always hope that surprises me, confronts me, beckons me. Faith, hope, and love, these three, what will remain. So everything else will pass away. Why is hope so important? Because we're lost without it. The heart can't live without hope. And Danielle, you've traveled all over the world and coming out of the brokenness of your past, ministering to some of the most broken people that I think many would probably avoid because they wouldn't know what to do or how to help. Tell us some more of your encounters that we just need to hear today.
Yeah, sure. I was actually thinking I'd like to share Flower's story. I was just talking to her the other day. She lives in England now, but I met her in the downtown east side of Vancouver, which is a drug addicted community. It's a kind of a slum. And I met her. She was never interested in talking to our community. We had moved into that neighborhood to try to be Jesus and church plant. And she would always give us these signals she wasn't interested. And by that, I mean like a finger, you know, the one, and just shout at us, you know, like, stay away, you know. And so I was on rollerblades one night, prayer rollerblading. I don't know. I recommend this for hopefulness. We were literally just we're rolling up to people say like, hey, we're holy rollers. What's a prayer? Like, just ridiculous. We're just trying to have some fun. And it worked really well because it turns out people who are high think that's funny. So we were like, we were praying for people all night long. I had this person that was new to the community with me. And so I could see Flower, you know, that's her street name. I could see her, and even everyone was afraid of her. Even the police were afraid of her because she used to stab people with dirty needles. I mean, she was like aggressive, very, very, but I was praying for, ever since she gave me the signal, I was praying for her, every day, God, make a way, you know? And actually earlier that morning, I had left my apartment in this concrete sort of urban drug addicted city. And I saw this little flower poking up through the sidewalk. You know how you see that?
Yeah.
And you just sort of go like, wow, like a flower, like a little tiny flower can actually poke itself through the cement, all these layers of oppression. Anyway, so I had this visual image in my mind, and then I saw a flower and we went over and I gave her the line, and just like uncharacteristically, she laughed her head off. And then she just started pouring out her life story, which is as broken as you might be able to imagine, maybe a little bit worse. And in the middle of the story, my friend had to go home. It was just me on rollerblades talking to Flower at the corner of Main and Hastings, which is nicknamed Pain and Wastings, and for obvious reasons. And she said to me, look, I got to go fix, like I'm dying here. But if you would come sit by me while I fix, I'd like to keep talking to you. And I remember thinking like, I don't know if you're supposed to do that. Like, you know, all of the logical things in my mind are going firing off. Like, you know, there's no ministry manual that covered this one, but I felt God said to me, look, you prayed every day for a year, and you might not want to blow this one, you know? So I was like, okay. So I went and sat down, excruciatingly painful, 20 minutes while she tried to find a vein that would work. All her veins were shut down.
Wow.
She couldn't find a vein that would work. And I felt all the hope leaving my body. I was praying very bold prayers for that community. And I felt the enemy kind of say to me this like deep sense of despair, like, you think you can transform this community? You can't even help one girl. And I was like, yeah, I can't even help one girl. And then all of a sudden this thought just like dropped, that visual of that flower. And I feel like God, by his Holy Spirit, spoken to me, flowers were meant to bloom. And it dawned on me in the moment that flowers, that flower was the name she had chosen as her street name. And even that name had prophetic power for life. And so I just started to say flowers were meant to bloom. Flowers were meant to bloom. And she eventually, a friend had come by and shot her in the neck. So she was high. And she, when she got high, of course, it's demonic. She just started saying all these horrible things. But she came back to my house. We were trying to sober her up and keep her safe. And I, with my friend, we picked up a guitar. We just sang the song, Flowers Are Meant to Bloom, over her. And while we were singing, she just fell asleep. And she fell asleep for 3 days. I can't even make this up. Full on, did not wake up for 3 days. I thought I knew my singing was bad. I hadn't killed anybody yet. But I was like, oh no, I kept checking
her
pulse.
This isn't in the manual either. Yeah.
That's right. I kept checking her pulse just in case, and she was alive and well. And 3 days later, she wakes up and she says, I need God. That's her first, she sat up after 3 days of sleep and she said, I need God. And that, you know, and that began a journey where I led her to Jesus, and Jesus was with her and part of her. And now she understands that she was born to live and not to die. And lots of things. She still struggles with mental health issues. You know, but she's alive. She's well. I just talked to her the other day in England. You know, she's convinced and knows God. She lives a grace-filled life. She knows that she's loved and wanted and known by her Father. Flowers were meant to bloom. That's, you know, this is an eternal promise that life, that what God has planned to live, is supposed to be able to poke through all of the cement in the world. Wow. And no matter what city plan, no matter how good a city planner is, he can't stop life. You can't control the flowers. You know, God said, this is why we don't even have to worry. Look at the flowers. I'm in charge of this life. I'm in charge of living things. So I feel like that idea, I would have said, if you could have chosen one person that was like too late, too hard, it would have been her. Too late, too hard. And that's where God began. That's where God begins. At our too late and too hard is where God begins. That's hope.
That is hope indeed. What do you say to the person listening today who feels, on one hand, terrified of stepping out into uncomfortable situations that you seem really comfortable in, but they're thinking, what can I do with what I have in my hand? How can I not only activate hope, but inspire hope by just being who I am and offering what I have?
Yeah, I think you said it beautifully. I think it always starts where you are, like what's in front of you, who are the people around you. And hope cannot be transferred because it's not stagnant. It's not a principle. I mean, you can tell people beautiful things about hope all you want, but hope is actually caught. It's infectious. It's alive. It's living. Think about like fire, the way that fire moves. So I would say that your hopeful living, the posture of your life, the way that you live hopefully in the world, is how you affect people around you with hope.
Hey, amen. You've been saying a lot lately on the show that how are people going to ask about the hope within us if they don't see any hope on us? And truly, if we're not stewarding our perspective and even our story in a way that inspires hope, I mean, I feel like one of my passions is to see the body of Christ healed, because as we give God access to those basement places that we've stuffed down and we're kind of over-serving to compensate for, when hope arises because healing happens, you'll see hope on your face. You'll wear hope, and people will ask about the hope that's within you. But boy, the world needs hope so desperately, don't they? Don't we?
Yeah. And we sure do. I need it daily. Yeah. And actually, interesting, even in a recovery background, when people share in a recovery circle, what they're asked to do is share their experience and hope. That's what they share.
Wow.
And it's a powerful idea that, because when they usually share, they share some of the things that probably most of us would never share, like those parts of our lives that we don't want to talk about, those things that we've suppressed forever. And this is where I really say on a regular basis, like, hope is not happy. It's honest. And the more honest you can get about who you are, the more authentic you are, the more real you are, the more you meet God in those places of real authenticity, the more your experience is hope and can become that for somebody else.
Well, the posture of the heart you were talking about with humility and dependence and true humility, having a right view of yourself in light of how God sees you and dependence, and that's how you posture yourself before the Lord. When you look around, Danielle, at this, the shape of culture, the how fast things are moving, talk about just, you know, when the enemy is coming in, trying to bring despair, discouragement, and steal hope. What is your perspective for the times we're in? How do you find hope as you continue to trust in God and walk humbly before Him? I mean, what do you sense the Lord saying to you about the times we're in?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is interesting. I think there is a lens, there's a kingdom perspective that God's inviting us to have. And it's not like a happy Pollyanna optimism. It's not like everything's going to be fine because I'm a Christian and no matter what's going on, I'm going to like ignore it. But also it's not a denial that God is at work in the world. It's not a despair that gives up on the capacity and the potential for God's creative order. So I would say that it's really about how we view things, and it starts in the mirror, and then it actually goes to who it is that's around us. Is we stop seeing people through their social disguises. So whatever that is, whatever label they are, maybe in America, it's a lot about politics or socioeconomics, or it can be about color, or it can be about gender. There's all these different layers that the world has, and we see things through these layers. And I would say that we've been on a steady diet of fear for years now.
Yeah.
And that fear has been like, it literally has been reforming us. Fear will always breed despair. Fear will always breed hate. Like, fear is the tactic of the enemy. Hope is the currency of the kingdom. So what I would suggest is, whenever you're feeling afraid, whenever you're viewing people even through the lens of fear, I would say, ask God, and practice this even when you're in praying. I instruct people often to come with me on beholding walks, what I call beholding walks, and where we're just like looking for God at work in my neighborhood. I just like go looking for where God is at work in my neighborhood and see if I could join Him there. And you wouldn't believe how hopeful it is to do that. Even in the downtown East Side, I remember going on beholding walks. Where is God at work in this community, and how can we join Him? And you'll see Him everywhere. Like, God is literally alive and well and doing incredible things on the planet. And because we're on the steady diet of fear, it lends itself into cynicism and then leads, of course, to despair. But indeed, if we could actually change the way we see, we would change everything.
Indeed. Wow. So good. If you could gather all Christians in the West together and you had the mic, what would you charge us with? What would you say?
I'd say, don't be afraid. And I would say, love extravagantly.
So good. Just got about a minute and a half left. You have a chapter titled Sorrow, Not Defeat. And I've been thinking about, you know, with this currency of fear, this diet we've been consuming in the last few years, especially, there's been a lot of loss too. And, you know, there needs to be a place for grief and lament and sorrow, but not defeat. So speak to that if you would.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting thing. I think because we haven't been trained to be honest, then sorrow feels like despair. Because we think like we're supposed to live these happy lives. But if we could get honest, I mean, lament, or what we call in the New Testament repentance, which is what Paul calls a godly sorrow that leaves no regrets. If we could actually get honest enough and lament and be sorry in those places for pain and for brokenness and for our part in it, but also like things that have been done for us, that's where all the healing occurs. So even if you think about this institutionally, like the church has actually had some issues with exposing leaders and systems and stuff that have been oppressive and difficult and hard. And often the impulse is to like, oh, that's not going to be good for the church. We should cover it up. You know what I mean? We should excuse it real quick and move on with it. And I'm always like, you're missing where all the hope lies for the future. Wow. By doing that. Mm-hmm. You're missing actually the authentic place of sorrow, of lament, that actually holds the hope of change for the future. And I always feel like I just want to like take leaders, church leaders everywhere or institution leaders everywhere, and say, stop denying and minimizing and trying to move on. That's not what we need right now, because that's not hope. That is not hope for the future. That's despairing behavior, because it's not authentic or honest. Try to get honest and we'll get hopeful.
Come on. This has been awesome. Danielle, please come back again. Thanks for the way that you steward the kingdom assignment. And friends, I pray you found some encouragement here today. Hope does need to make a comeback. We'll meet you back here next time. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Susie Larson Live. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can become a supporter now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link to spread the good news of the gospel and to grow the impact of the show. Also, if you would, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player, and never miss a show.